Moving right along, if the panelists and our moderator will approach the stage, we're going to get going with our first panel discussion. Content wrangling, right? A new term within the last, say, 10 years, right? We have on-set data wranglers. There's a lot of wrangling going on. There's a lot of wrangling. So we're talking about wrangling content to maximize the consumer experience. So we're kind of getting really deep into it, starting with the consumer and kind of ending with the consumer, and a lot of fire hose data and information in between. So get ready. Please join me in welcoming, she's a wonderful moderator. She's sat on our Smart Content Council for a few years, and we won't say how many, you and I. She's the founder and president of Janssen Entertainment and Media Services Consulting. Please give a warm welcome to Nona Janssen-Walls.
Guys saying seven, so we'll just leave it at less than 10. It's been a really great ride. Most of the time I'm participating out on the West Coast. I'm really happy to be here on the East Coast and meeting some folks in different industries around publishing and kind of with a different take on what we do out in Hollywood. So definitely great to be here. And so with me, I'll let you guys introduce yourselves. Thank you for coming.
Hi, my name is Mark Coatney. Most recently at Forbes, and have spent a lot of time in media since the days when it was pretty dumb content, and hoping to make it a little smarter.
I'm Grant Nodine, National Hockey League, and I'm in charge of our archive, and also in charge of a lot of our R&D efforts about, you know, how we bring content into our systems, whether it's for internal use or external.
So that's a great segue into kind of what we want to start talking about. And so the entire panel is about wrangling content. You know, content is key as far as attracting and retaining audiences, getting people really to buy into the brand. As a studio, my most recent engagement was at Lionsgate, and it's really, really tough because, you know, you say the name of the studio, Lionsgate, people don't really know what that means, but you say John Wick and Hunger Games, and the heads start going up and down. I would imagine you both have those same situations, and you have a mass amounts of content that maybe aren't necessarily connected to the overall brand. So can you talk a little bit about kind of the different types of content that you produce and how that helps you attract and retain customers or fans?
Well, you know, so a lot of the content that I'm sucking into my system is actually internal content that's used for reviewing goals and running our business and making sure that we're putting the best product on the ice and making sure that we're, you know, fixing problems with the game that surface from kind of understanding what trends are happening on the ice. So a lot of those angles, a lot of the way that we kind of introduce new technologies is through testing with the goal review folks and the officiating folks and the people looking at player rule infractions and things like that, and looking at the things that the improvements that we can make there that we can then pass on to kind of identifying content and surfacing content for fans.
And Forbes is pretty sprawling. If you've ever looked at the site, it's you know, we're slightly different than a lot of media companies in the sense that probably 75% of the content produced is produced by non-Forbes staffers, which are the Forbes contributors. And they're producing hundreds of articles a day on our website, you know, on mobile platforms. We have an app that we've experimented with that's more, you know, kind of traditional staff-written magazine content. We obviously have social channels, we have podcasts, we have, you know, video, we do, you know, we touch a lot of places, and so kind of managing all that is obviously a challenge.
Well, I think that's definitely really interesting, and from your perspective, that was a very, very specific around content for content's sake and content for attracting people to your publication or to your website. On the NHL side, as far as these statistics and the operational data that you're collecting, is that somehow transformed into how can we help that maximize the consumer experience, your audience experience? Like, are you publishing, hey, this guy breaks this particular rule all the time, he's kind of a badass, or?
Well, I don't know that we go there exactly, but generally speaking, yes, statistics is the lifeblood of every application that we write. So whether it, you know, whether it's how we track expenses even, down to how we manage the ice surface in the arenas. So, you know, statistics about what's the temperature of the ice in various zones. How do we effectively cool this building, so to speak? Coaches with iPads on the benches that are analyzing video in real time as the game's ongoing and sharing insights from play that happened a minute ago with players that have just come off the ice to help them better compete against their opponents. So there's video is used in so many different parts of the business, and the statistics is all embedded along with that video. And so we're introducing a chip-based puck and player tracking system this year that will basically give you 60 samples per second of players' positioning and the puck's positioning on the ice, and you'll get an amazing increase in the amount of stats data that happens. So right now we're at about 300 stats events per game, and they're recorded by 5 off-ice officials on laptops right now. And after we've implemented this system, we're essentially going to get to about 3,000 per game. And a lot of those are just related to kind of things that we couldn't track effectively with people doing it on laptops that we can now track based on just having that where's player A, where's player B, where are the referees standing. So let's just take an example of where the referees are standing. So we're going to continue to train our officials so that they do a better and better job every game in and game out, and make sure that the product on the ice is as fair and impartial as it can be, which is the entire purpose of having a league, right? We're analyzing on every kind of goal where the officials are located on the ice, whether they're in the proper position to actually see the play effectively and make the right call. And obviously that falls through into coaches' challenges and goal reviews and things like that. How can we be better and not miss calls?
So from a technology perspective, first of all, you know that people are still going to complain and yell at the ref and throw things at him.
Absolutely.
But that being said, are you in this particular phase or future phase going full Internet of Things with sensors on the pucks and sensors on the refs and sensors on the players?
Well, yeah, that's actually what we're rolling out this year, is there's a chip inside the puck, and that was a material science miracle almost. Chips on the players, it's going to create a lot of new statistics. I mean, and I think a lot of what's kind of driven some of this has been gambling. You've had this scenario where you've got the sports radars of the world sending people to games with a little iPhone app who are actually logging the events in the game faster than we can get the official statistics out. So now you're saying, well, if I want to be able to reap the benefits of kind of what's going to be spent in the gaming industry around hockey, I've got to be faster than Sports Radar. And that means I've got to drive the latency of that data collection, so hence the actual chip-based puck and player tracking. I've got to be able to drive the latency of that down to where it's much faster than a human being sitting on an iPhone.
Well, and in this case, we've been saying data is a new currency, data is a new oil. Data is currency for you at this point in time. You're productizing it, you're monetizing it.
Data has always been currency. I mean, the statistical metadata that we have around the game makes all kinds of decisions at the team level and at the league level. So at the team level, obviously they're using statistics to make decisions about which players to sign and which players not to sign. The way that works obviously has gotten more and more sophisticated as time goes by, and I expect that a new era will be born kind of in that realm as well. But generally speaking, it's across the board, statistics has informed kind of the business for years. And I think that's true of any sports league, but.
Yep, I'm a big baseball fan, and we all know how baseball is on statistics.
Yeah, they have quite a lot.
So let's take a little bit, a different angle on this, because we are supposed to be talking about consumers. And so give me a little insight on your companies or what you see in the industry around collecting consumer data. You've got your first-party data, your subscribers, maybe people that use your mobile apps or are on fan sites. You've got your second-party data, maybe from business transactions with partners or third-party sales. And then, of course, you've got pure third-party data, the axioms of the world, where you're actually buying information about the people that you think that you know. And so how have your companies used that? What's worked? What hasn't worked?
That's interesting. I feel like there's, you know, we still, and this is not just Forbes, I think a lot of places are still, you know, kind of scratching the surface of what you can do with that data. I think, you know, traditionally with a lot of media companies, the way we look at the data is like, what are the things that, you know, trigger a subscriber event or something like that. A harder thing is how do you use that any data to determine who's going to be retained? You know, I think, you know, we look at someone like Netflix is a very good example, someone who really focuses hard on, you know, what are the retaining events. That's something we, you know, have really tried to work on at Forbes. We've had some experiments, and we may talk about this later, around data that didn't work, which I think is also valuable. We tried an app in which the data we wanted to collect was, would people be motivated to subscribe for a time-based thing instead of an issue-based thing? So in other words, you downloaded the Forbes app and you gave us a couple dollars and you could read whatever you wanted, but only for 2 hours or for 2 days or something like that. Completely failed. But that was a good experiment to see if anybody wanted to do that. And I think that, you know, kind of collecting data and then seeing if it totally does not work is also just as valuable as getting actionable stuff.
Well, and interestingly enough, that does work in entertainment, right? You download something that you rent from Netflix or Amazon or whatever service you're using, and you get it for 24, 48 hours, whatever that is, and then you just don't have rights to it anymore. So it's a model that works, just maybe not in that particular industry.
Right, and it could just be that, you know, we didn't try hard enough, we didn't present it in the right way because it was unusual. You know, I mean, it was a behavior that you don't see in other, you know, kind of print-based things, and so maybe people are just like, this is really weird, and maybe we should have stuck with it, you know, for sure.
How about over on the NHL side?
So I would say that we recognized kind of that direct-to-customer data collection and streaming was really not in our wheelhouse, and did a deal with Major League Baseball Advanced Media 3 years ago. And so they actually have the rights to our fan-facing new media content. I say new media because for lack of a better word for it, but or OTT content. So we kind of have focused our efforts on what new content can we make of what insights can we derive so that we can identify the new content that we can make available to fans that will enhance what they're already consuming. So sorry to harp on the puck and player tracking data, but to go back to that, as higher resolution cameras become available and you start putting 4K and 8K cameras into the arenas for coaching and for broadcast and things like that, you're able to go and use this tracking data to go and crop virtual angles for everybody on the ice, including the officials. So I've just taken one camera and produced 30 plus feeds from a forward and reverse angle. And so now we have a bunch more content to surface for fans. And I think kind of I've also been kind of focused on the business-to-business side of this, which is that, we produce a lot of PR-based kind of promotional content and kind of shoulder content that's meant to be included in a broadcast. Now, we have 36 different broadcast rights holders. So, predicting what's going to kind of resonate with any given one of them is kind of hard. So we've been really lacking the usage data for the content that we provide to them. So scenics of the outside of the arena, interviews with historical, figures, interviews with, players, biographical pieces about players, and it's stuff to be meant to be played and during intermissions or timeouts or whatever, and so we've done a good job producing that content, but we've done a really kind of less than good job about collecting analytics about how the broadcasters are actually using it. We're still very much in the did you see they played our biographic piece on the air last night. Okay, great, but we should have known that because they downloaded it from us. So that's kind of an area of focus as well. We're training a couple of AI models to start to recognize events in the game as the game's occurring, so that those can kind of surface potential social media things and things like that. So.
Well, and that's an interesting point on the B2B side, as well as just from a consumer perspective. You're producing the content, you're collecting the content, you're getting all the data, and that's all fabulous. But what about, you know, in telephony, it's last mile. What about that last inch or last centimeter, if you see the size of some of the phones, getting that to the consumer in a seamless and easy to use and adoptable fashion? Have there been any kind of breakthroughs there on either side?
I mean, we're continuing to explore kind of new ways to present our content. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff related to AR and VR that's really interesting that's going on.
Like put you in the game?
It does kind of put you right in the game. I mean, the VR stuff that we tested at CES this year was used the sample tracking data that we were generating to be able to let you view the game as it was unfolding from the perspective of any player on the ice. So you could go and say, I want to see the game from the perspective of the goaltender. You select the goaltender, and all the players are kind of moving around on the ice based on the tracking data, you know, and so you're kind of in the game. Now, that said, tracking data is great, but it can't tell you whether a player's got his arm raised or the stick is facing this way or over that way. So there's still kind of miles to go on that road, and I think that ultimately we end up with a hybrid optical kind of and chip-based solution. But again, you're going to go and use machine vision to do optical tracking. That's a whole nother massive amounts of data with 1,300 plus games a season that you're going to try to manage and make available in an easy to use way and with an API that's extensible, so that not only can you use it for your own uses, but you can start to give it to partners and sponsors and things like that, so that they can take advantage of it.
I mean, one thing that's interesting on our end, too, is that, you know, we're not just serving, obviously, the reader, but also a large constituency of creators. And so a lot of our data work, too, has been around AI, around, I guess you would call it kind of intelligence around completing the sentence. So things that prompt are, you know, now we use sometimes, if you're a Forbes contributor, you'll see, like, kind of story recommendations or story idea recommendations based on things that are trending on our site. So we can say, like, oh, contributor X, do you know that this kind of topic is doing well and you might want to cover that? Or further afield, we're starting to do things that are similar to what you get in, like, your Gmail kind of predictive response kind of things, where you start typing something and we say, oh, I think you're talking about this company, we might finish the sentence for you to help you produce, you know, content faster and easier, which helps them and us.
Okay. That's very interesting. And so if someone wanted to become a Forbes contributor, we talk about that afterwards.
Yes, of course.
So we started to talk about the technology a little bit, and one of the things I think that's really important is, you know, looking at the stack. And it's not the most exciting piece of data and analytics, and it's certainly not the most sexy piece that everyone's driven to, but it is very, very important to make sure that you build your technology stack, something you're betting on their future, you're betting on your partners, you're making sure you're really integrated with them. So have you done a lot of, it sounds like with Hockey, you've just, not just, I've got friends at BAMTech, and I know they're very, very skilled at what they do, so you've turned a lot of that over to BAMTech.
Yeah, as far as the consumer side goes, yeah, I mean, you know, we're kind of continuing to use, so we're using AI to optimize encode profiles for our video. So basically, a computer can go and iterate over multiple profile settings much faster than a human being can do it. And with the public cloud, you can basically achieve that pretty rapidly. So you got content improvement, right? So the improvement of the quality of the content. But then also, obviously most people are concerned with using data for discovery, right? But I think there's so many different ways that we can start to use this data to make our business better that are outside of tracking what people are looking at.
Like what?
Well, like I said, so improving the quality of encoding, decreasing the turnaround time for producing highlight clips. I think right now you could almost do automated highlights in hockey, and it's probably one of the hardest things to do because we have continuous play and there's not really a beginning and an end to most plays. So it's really kind of maturing to the point where you've got this kind of this ever-increasing bunch of content that you're creating because you've done a good job leveraging the data that you have, and now you've got to go and connect the dots on the other end and say, how are we doing? In other words, so what of this content that we're surfacing is resonating, and how would you like it to be given to you?
And how do we produce and deliver more of that thing?
I'm sorry, I just said that raised an interesting point to me, is how useful is your back archive to you? Like, you know, old games or old, you know, I mean, since it won't have the same data associated with it as obviously your new stuff.
Well, I think what's happening in archival, obviously, a lot of people are talking about, oh, let's move our archive to the cloud. And I actually think that it's, and I kind of came to this conclusion yesterday, but I actually think that what's actually going to happen is we're going to push our content primarily into the cloud first to give us quick delivery options, right? But also so that we can pass it through multiple AI models and collect data about it, and then we're going to suck it back into our on-prem archive. And now, a sports league is kind of atypical for a content business because I've got an archive that is going to be perpetual and is meant to last forever, and I'm never going to throw things away. And essentially, it grows by, right now, it grows by 7 petabytes a year. So it's going to be getting quite large quite quickly, and that's, I think, the costs and the potential risk of putting it into a public cloud provider is pretty hard to get past. So I think it remains primarily an on-prem endeavor, but I also believe that you'll go and have a hybrid model that says, I'm going to put a year's worth of archival content out in the cloud, and I'm going to continue to use that to enhance my ability to discover things about that content so that I can then pull them back and make my historical archive more valuable.
And on the Forbes side, as far as historical issues or things that, you know, something happens to a celebrity or something happens to a person of interest, and all of a sudden you want to pull all that archived footage. Gloria Vanderbilt's a great example of someone who just passed away who, you know, has a history beyond real content.
Yeah. I mean, Forbes has some of that. I mean, like a lot of print things that didn't really anticipate the internet in 1942, because Forbes is more than 100 years old. There's a lot of stuff that, especially around photography, we don't really have the rights to, unfortunately. So what you'll see a lot of magazine archives in particular is text, you know, but not necessarily the images that go with it. But we do that, and we're always trying to, you know, find ways to kind of release more images. But there's, you know, all that, it's all non-standard, needs a lot of, you know, cleanup work, and you know, kind of making the case for value is sometimes difficult as well.
Yeah, I can imagine. One of the things, you know, entertainment is another one where we keep everything forever, mostly from a data perspective because we potentially could owe royalties on it forever. But in other cases, because there's lots of fans, there's lots of people that want to see things, you know, that happened back in 1930, 1940, not quite as far back, but certainly interesting.
One of my earlier incarnations, I put the Archive of Time magazine online, and I remember we were so, like, kind of flip about our history that we had to buy a couple issues on eBay because we didn't have them in our, and if, had they known that we were so desperate to buy them, the price would have been much more than the, you know, $3 or whatever we paid.
Yeah, no, we had a similar thing with Lionsgate when we bought a particular library, and with that came a bunch of episodes of the Comedy Hour at the Apollo Theater, which was a show that ran back in the 70s or 80s. And while we had the information about the overall series, the information about the episodes were not nowhere to be found. We even had somebody, I mean, we got to the point where someone went to the Apollo Theater, not a big deal if you live here, but if you live in LA, it's a little bit farther to go, and the theater didn't have anything. And so some poor soul, it's comedy, so it shouldn't have been that bad, but some poor soul had to sit and capture all of that metadata and record it for us. And it's just one of those, you know, kind of obscure cases that definitely happen. So three of the things that we were supposed to talk about, which I think that we have, were customer-focused offerings, the technology integration, and a data strategy. So we haven't talked too much about a data strategy. Is this something that you set out to do and you figured out your strategy, or at least as much as you could, and then adjusted it as you went? Or, like is the case in many cases, were you thrown a bunch of data, the fire hose effect, and you figured out where to put it, and a strategy kind of evolved and you went with that, or something in between?
I think it's mostly an evolving thing for us, obviously. There's just so much more of it. And obviously we're getting ready to explode it with tracking data, with virtual camera angles. It's starting to become a kind of a management exercise to say, where am I going to put this data? How am I going to make sure that it continues to be portable? If I decide to put it in a public cloud, make sure that I can get it back out of the public cloud in a easy way. A lot of the reason why we're keeping the archive on-prem for the time being. But also, how do you enrich the data in ways that, you haven't really contemplated before? That's the real mental exercise that I think is the one worth having.
I mean, as benefits, and again, I don't think a company with a big history, we had a lot of data from a lot of different sources, and magazine subscriber databases don't necessarily talk to online membership databases and all that kind of stuff. But weirdly, one of the biggest challenges is often managing expectations in a newsroom where people are like, go quickly from like, oh, cool, I can see how well my story is doing, and to why isn't my story doing better, and what are you doing about it? And so that sometimes the data is not always stuff you want to surface to people.
Yeah, some of those conversations can be quite difficult, yeah? Like, what do you want the data to say, and when it doesn't, how do you deliver that? Well, as you guys can probably tell, we could talk about this all day, but we do want to leave some time for questions. So anyone in the audience have anything to contribute or ask to our esteemed panel here?
Oh, I'm coming.
Hey there. I had a quick question about data inside your content. For example, citizen journalism, data in news, and similarly sports stats, that kind of thing. What role do you see that sort of taking, current state, future state?
So you mean data that around the actual words, but images and stuff that are produced? Is that the idea? Or?
Having data be a part of your content.
Oh, I see. I think in my experience, it's something that everyone wants to do and people don't do as well. Newsrooms in particular that I've always been associated with always kind of talk about it more as this great goal, but they don't actually deliver on it because so few people actually know what to do with it. I've seen some great data journalists, and you're seeing it more in places like The Times has done a really heavy investment in that, in terms of visualizing data and collecting data. Forbes, we think about data a lot, but it's a more conventional, I don't want to say conventional because it's very hard data to get, but our big data thing is always our ranking of wealth, of wealthy individuals, our wealth lists and things like that. That's a huge data project, most of which is hidden from the public, because we just kind of give the top line items. But that's a really big thing that, people don't necessarily think about is like data journalism, but it's very data driven. It just doesn't present in the same way as what you think about.
Okay, we have another question over here.
How have you started to redefine roles on teams? Because when you become so data-centric, and if you're really trying to drive business from the data, it completely re-architects kind of the traditional IT organization, environment, business analyst, those kind of old, very siloed roles. You need these kind of new business architects, data ops, all those type of new roles, and then you need the political support to invest in all that. So what's been your experiences going through that?
I think it's been a mix of things. I mean, I think there's some roles that you've had to go and hire new people for, plainly, because some of it is so daunting that trying to train somebody internally is not going to work well. That said, a lot of people, we're trying to retrain a lot of people and say, hey, you've got to start moving your skills to a hybrid public-private cloud platform so that you understand how those things interact, and you understand some of the tools that are available to you in the cloud that are not familiar to traditional systems people or traditional DevOps folks. I think it's a big effort, and I think also it's about how we foster communication in the office between people in roles that traditionally use data, but don't really understand kind of how it was stored, and you now have to really have both understandings, right? And you have to understand the art of the possible, so to speak, in terms of what kind of analytics can I actually run? What's like what's a reasonable time frame to actually be able to crunch this data? And how much compute am I willing to pay for to get it?
All right. Well, thank you guys. If you help, join me in thanking Mark and Grant for a great panel. They'll be around afterwards, and I'm sure happy to have more conversations.